Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Ralph Sutton, the SDR Show. This week, honored to have bass legend Billy Sheehan. You might know him from Talas, from David Lee Roth, from Mr. Big, or countless other things. Just a super cool dude. We get into some deep conversations with Billy. And if you were a fan of Billy's, you could have heard this 5 days ago exclusively at GasDigitalNetwork.com. Sans commercials. And as I said, available 5 days earlier at GasDigitalNetwork.com. You just use the code SDR. You get a 7-day free trial. You get access to every episode ever since the dawn of SDR time. And you get access to the 21 other shows on Gas Digital. 35 hours of entertainment every week, commercial-free in HD at GasDigitalNetwork.com. Use the code SDR. Try it out. See what you think. We're doing it every Wednesday, every Saturday, 9 p.m. at Gas Digital for SDR. But really, just listen or watch anywhere you want. That's the important thing. And here it is right now, the Billy Sheehan episode of The SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show.
It is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. I am Ralph Sutton. Back with me once again. You know, if it's going to be like a cool rock and roll dude, we go to a cool rock and roll dude. Dodd Jamison is back on the show with us. Thank you, buddy. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here with you and Shannon and the bass maestro himself, Billy Sheehan.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. So I got to give you the proper introduction. Not only does his career span 6 fucking decades, voted best rock bass player 5 times, Talas, David Lee Roth, Mr. Big, Winery Dog, Sons of Apollo, Niacin. I mean, the list goes on and on. It is Mr. Billy Sheehan. Thank you so much for coming on the show, buddy.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to see you guys. And Don, it's been a long time. Great to see you, bro.
You too. How's Isabella doing?
Elisabetta is great.
Good, good. Everyone's healthy?
It's her birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we went out last night, and Richie Kotzen was playing in town. So I got up and played a song with him, and we all had a wonderful time.
I like to establish where your priorities are. It's Isabella's birthday, but you know what? Come on the SDR show during the birthday. Fuck that. I like it. And in doing a little research, by the way, I will say your cat is adorable. How about that? I noticed that on your Instagram. Very cute.
Yeah, Rebel. He's 18 pounds now. He's a big boy. He's a great cat, Rebel. He's a absolute lunatic. There are a few screws loose in this cat.
All right, so I'm going to tell you my Billy Sheehan story. So, you used to come on my radio show years ago called The Tour Bus. I actually think you were in this room at one point with Winery Dogs.
Yep.
But we were backstage. I hosted the M3 Rock Festival for, I think, 4 or 5 years. And you played both with Winery Dogs and Mr. Big. And I'm not sure when this happened exactly, but I was there with my co-host of The Tour Bus radio show, this girl, Melissa. We're talking to you guys backstage. You accidentally bump into her and knocked her glass of wine out of her hand unintentionally, right? And she's like, yeah, no big deal. And you're like, no, let me fix this. You bring us onto your tour bus in your dressing room backstage, give her like a fucking bottle of wine. We hung out for an hour. You're giving us recipes for your pork with apples and all this other stuff. We ended up hanging out for like an hour and a half. And it just is, you're just a good dude. You're a good dude, Billy. That's what it is.
You're too kind. You're too kind to say that. Very nice.
Billy would never spill wine on purpose, trust me.
Good point.
So I want to ask you this, Billy. So we'll go back to the beginning. As I said, we're going to talk about a very interesting thing that's happening with your original band, Talas. But before we even get into that, as a rock and roll fan, maybe the average person can name 5 or 6 rock bass players. I think that's a fair assessment, unless you're a super fan of bass. So my question to start with, that I've never asked you this, little Billy Sheehan, William Sheehan at the time, because you weren't known by Bill yet. You're looking to start in music. What drew you to the bass as opposed to guitar, drums? Like, why the bass? Let's just start with that.
Okay. Fair question. And my block right around the corner from my house was Joe Hesse lived there, Joe and his brother Jim. And they were older than I, and my brother and sisters were older. I was a little kid. And they had a band, and they played, and Joe was a bass player. And Joe was the coolest guy in our neighborhood. He had a Triumph motorcycle, a beautiful girlfriend. He even walked cool. You could see from blocks away that it was Joe coming. They had Joe's strange little walk that he did. And so he played bass. I wanted to be like him. And I went over to his house one day, and they wouldn't let me in because I'm a little kid. I had to sit out in the driveway and listen to the band rehearse, the windows shake. And at night, I had to go to bed early, so I'd be in my bed, and I could hear the bass from the distance, you know. And then when they'd load the gear in, the guitar player carried this little amp, and then the bass had like two guys carrying this amp. So I thought, the bass it's much more significant than the guitar. And the guitar had those thin little strings like cheese cutter, velvet. And the bass had this massive thing. So I just went for it. I don't know. I didn't realize that guitar was the glory instrument, and I was we're the working men of the band. So
yeah, it is funny because you obviously when you think, well, what the hell was that?
Don't worry about that. I apologize. I can't get that thing to stop.
I would say you'd go Geddy Lee, Les Claypool, John Entwistle, maybe Flea and Billy Sheehan. Like those are the five or six that come to mind to the average person. So it is fascinating, especially when you started to look at it as more than just a backup instrument, as an actual instrument where there are bass solos and there's a lot of bass in all the bands that you're in, where it became where people, you inspired people to play a bass, which I don't know how many times that happened before then, really.
Well, I was inspired by guys that played like that. Tim Boger from the Vanilla Fudge, Jack Bruce was all over, Counterpoint with Eric Clapton and Crossroads, Paul Samuel Smith with the Yardbirds way early. Most of your listeners don't even know. Was going toe-to-toe with Jeff Beck. And so that was a kind of a thing. And Paul McCartney, All Over the Neck.
Right.
A little help from my friends. It's like an extended bass solo, the whole thing. Jamie Jamerson, all the Motown songs all over the place. And I played in a three-piece band, so we didn't have a rhythm guitar player or keyboards. So if we made $100, that's $33 each. We would have added another guy. It's only $25 each. So I picked up the slack as best I could with the bass. So when we would do "Burn" by Deep Purple, I do the keyboard solo on the bass.
Oh, that's cool. That's
so it would be there. So that was a way for us to extend our meager salaries a little bit more and not have to carry a giant Hammond B3 and Leslie and other gear. So it was some necessity to it there. But it was kind of cool. Early on, I listened to a lot of classical music, and the right hand and left hand of a classical keyboard, the left hand is the bass hand, so to speak, for the most part. And when it moves, it changes the character of what's happening on the right hand. Even though the right hand may repeat something, you move what's underneath it sounds different. So that always intrigued me, is to be the hidden element that makes things sound a little bit more musical.
Did you ever play an upright bass?
Yeah, I've had a few through the years. I have like an electric one now without the acoustic body. I had a beautiful one in the earthquake of 94, was it, in LA? It fell over and didn't survive the earthquake. So that was the last acoustic one I had.
All right, so now the reason for your coming on the show, also I figured it was your first time in SDR, I could be wrong, but so Talus was your first band. It started, as you said, as a three-piece, and then you changed it and brought in some other people. And look at Don Jameson trying to get on Billy Sheehan's good side, showing that Talus record.
Original copy, baby.
Wow, look at Billy over there. Jesus Christ, look at that hairdo. So a lot of people don't realize, like, Addicted to That Rush, which was a Mr. Big song, was actually a Talus song. The Shy Boy, which was a David Lee Roth song, was actually a Talus song. Talus, while respected by a lot, especially I think of what's his name, from Dream Theater, Portnoy, who was in the band with you. Like, these pictures of him wearing a Talas shirt at a Dream Theater show, like one of the first. People love Talas, but Talas never really got big. No offense. You know, it was like, it was, you got much bigger when you went on to join David Lee Roth or everything else. But it was, seems to be like the band that you always felt deserved more. And I feel a lot of fans did. And then you find, you find these tracks dating back to 1985 that would have been the third record of Talas. And you decide, let's get the band back together, so to speak. You write another new song or two, I think, for the record. And unfortunately, we lost Phil, I think, last year, the singer. But you got to record this record. Phil's kid is in the record, gets to see his dad be a rock star a little bit as well, gets to sing with him. This is a really unique moment. It's a very cool thing. Can you talk a little bit about how this all came together?
Well, yeah, absolutely. We tried to get signed with Talas for years and years and years. We live in Buffalo, New York. We had a now famous record company executive, Jason Flom, would fly up regularly to see the band. Don, you know who Jason is. And when we were on the Van Halen tour in 1980, we're on stage playing. And John Kolodner, the famous producer, record company exec, is on the side of the stage jumping up and down. This is the best live band in America. never signed us. Never. We went down to New York City for a showcase for Clive Davis from Arista Records. And we're at SIR, just the whole band, nobody there. And four chairs, Clive Davis and three other guys in suits. And we did our whole set as though there were 10,000 people there. And they loved it. And we're in touch with Eris. We're thinking, this is it, man. We got it. We're going to get signed finally. It's amazing. So they said, you know, we love the band live. Can you send us some more, just some more material so we can hear like what more you have? Sure thing. So we went in the studio, did a bunch more demos, sent them out there. They got the demos. Man, the demos are great. We love the demos. So, but how is the band live? Well, we just showcased, so it went on like that forever. And so it was one heartbreak after the other. Finally, in the end, we actually did get signed by Danny Goldberg, who later went on to manage Nirvana. He was a record company exec of David Lee Roth. Close enough.
Yeah. Go ahead, Don. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, was Dave knowing you obviously a result of you guys playing with Van Halen back in the day, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And we played a couple times in Buffalo where they showed up. We were playing this club called Stage One in Buffalo. It's a famous place because one Monday night, our opening act, somebody said, who's the opening act tonight for you guys? I said, it's some submarine band. I don't know the name. And I go, it's U2. Yeah, that was the band. So U2 actually opened up for Talas at this place because the local promoter, it was his showcase club when he wasn't doing big, giant stadium shows or 3,000 seaters. So I saw the Police's first tour, their show there. So we were playing that club the night Van Halen played, and they came out to the show, and they saw us there. And that guy later became the guy that ran that club, later became our manager and enabled us to get on the Van Halen tour in 1980. His name was Harvey Weinstein. You may have heard of him. He's no longer in business.
Yeah, well aware. That's pretty wild. It is pretty wild. So since you brought up, let's talk about that. So originally when David Lee Roth approached you, it wasn't to be in the band. He said it was for a movie. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. He needed a cover story to keep it confidential. I first got out to L.A. That was in summer of 85. Mm-hmm. Hence the name of the record. I didn't know what was going on. So I got there. Talas was going to open for Yngwie. We just got signed with a William Morris agency. So I called up Eddie Van Halen and said, hey, Ed, we're in town. We're going to play. You want to come out to the show? And he goes, oh, I'd love to. I'm kind of busy. You know, I go, OK, how are you doing otherwise? Blah, blah, blah. I go, oh, yeah. And I'm going over to see Dave tomorrow. He goes, you're what? And I go, Dave asked me to come over to his house for a meeting. What? Nobody knew that Dave had quit. I didn't know that Dave had quit.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
So he said, hey, after the meeting, call me right away because we think he's going to pull an Ozzy Osbourne, meaning He was going to leave the band and get a bunch of young guns and run off and do his thing. So I go out to have a meeting with Dave about the movie. And he goes, well, there is a movie, but that's not what I called you. Let's start a band. We'll find a guitar player. We'll find a drummer and let's go. So I'm standing outside of Dave's house in Pasadena thinking, wow, something just fell out of the skies and hit me on the head. So I thought to myself, okay, if I call Ed back and tell him what Dave said, Dave will probably say, see ya.
Right.
Because it's sworn to secrecy. And so I never called Eddie back. And until a couple of years after I had left Dave, we finally had a conversation and we laughed about it. But
so do you think when you told him that, when you spoke to Eddie and said you're going to Dave's house, that was like the nail in the coffin for him where he realized, oh, Dave is leaving? Like that call probably was what he needed, was that push to make him realize, oh, yeah, we're not just speculating. This is probably happening.
Yeah, that could have been. I didn't know every detail from behind. I just finished Ted Templeman's book, and he talked a lot about the Eat 'em and Smile Van Halen thingy there in that. It's a pretty interesting book. He was a wonderful guy, too. It was a wild time, and I couldn't tell the guys in the band because I was sworn to secrecy. So I'm doing the whole Yngwie Talas tour, knowing in the back of my mind, you guys, at the end of this, we have
meeting. That's pretty fucking wild. At least you know you could keep a secret. You got to tell someone a secret. Tell Billy Sheehan. He won't tell anybody. That's good news.
You guys are both cheating on your spouses.
Also, you keep together. The one thing I didn't know about that maybe you could elaborate on this, because there actually was a movie, the Crazy from the Heat movie script surfaced a few years ago. I didn't even know much. Can you elaborate? Like, what was the play? What was the game plan here with that?
Oh, it was just kind of a series of skits and funny things for the Dongo Inn, I think it was the name of some tropical place. And I still got a lot of the clothes and all the things, all the crazy clothes we wore on the Eat 'em and Smile tour. They were made for the movie. So I still got some of them in the archives. I'm going to donate them to charity at some point.
Who wrote this movie? Like, was it David wrote the movie? Like, what was the story here?
It was Dave and a team of writers. One of them was, his last name was Persigian. He wrote for a bunch of TV shows and all. Mm-hmm. And they, there were some cool aspects to it because we did a casting call in Hollywood and they needed girls in bikinis. So they had, place was jammed with about 1,000 girls in bikinis. And so Dave let me and Steve come and observe, you know.
It's nice that he would allow that to happen. That's nice. That's pretty much
you need to learn about show business, you know.
Yeah.
And also, speaking of which, I think this is right, that not that long ago, the Eat 'em and Smile lineup was supposed to reunite. And then the day of some sort of fire marshal thing, and it got pulled, but it was going to be all of you. And that never happened. Is that right?
Yeah, Lucky Strike Bowling has a jam night, and it's a real jam night. You get up on stage, you play, no sound check, no nothing, play, off, next, bang, play, off. And it was actually a lot of fun. And so we just thought, as a lark, me and Steve and Greg started talking, we should go up with Ralph from Steel Panther and do a couple of Eat 'em and Smile songs. Good idea. So we were just going to jump up, play, and that was it. And then somebody, I don't know who, said, so well, maybe call and see if Dave is in town, if he'd like to join us. So they did, and he said yes. So I had to call Ralph and say, Ralph, don't tell anybody, but Dave's going to come. So we, you know, thanks for offering, but we're gonna use him. And so he's a wonderful guy. I love him so much, and he's so hilarious.
He's a good dude. Cool. Also, you got to say Michael Starr, though, because you can't.
Oh,
say
that's right. Sorry, Michael Starr. So no sound check, no nothing. We're just gonna go up there, play two songs, and get off. No plan, no pay. It was all for free. It was just a lark to go up there. And we were on stage. And normally the club holds about 600 people. They'll let them get away with 650, maybe 675. Mm-hmm. And it's a jam. There was about 1,200 people in there. And my friends, they said they couldn't drink their drink because they couldn't get their arm up from their side.
Oh, man.
So crowded. So it was dangerous in a club like that. You got to be careful. If something that would have happened, that would have been a catastrophe of a lifetime. So I'm on the stage. There's a curtain closed. There's a little opening on the side where the hallway to get in is. And I see flashlights and firefighting gear and helmets and fully suited up firemen. And they came in and told the guy, shut it down.
So not a note was played?
One note was played. I forgot it was me or Steve. We just, you know, we were sitting and go, well, maybe we play a note. The crowd will cheer and the fire department will understand. So if it was me, I just went, and the one fireman looked, one more note and you're all going to jail.
Oh, man. That's crazy. It's so, because it would have been the first. That would have been the first time in 3 decades where the lineup was all there, right? God damn it.
But the cool thing was we went backstage, me, Steve, Greg, our keyboard player, Brett, who sadly lost recently, and with Dave, and we had a riot talking and reminiscing about the old days. So that was worth it for us. But it wasn't really like a lot of people think it was some kind of a planned gig or planned. We're just going to jump up and play. And unfortunately, it's and there was a line out front that went down Vineland, turned right on Hollywood Boulevard, and went another half a block when the club was already full. So
wow. That's wild. So
somebody got, somehow the word got out. Somebody not as good a secret keeper as Billy Sheehan.
Yeah. 100%. You know, my David Lee Roth cherished memory for myself. I was a strip club DJ for like 15 years, right? And he used to come into my strip club when I think Nile Rodgers was producing one of his records at one point. And he would come in and sit in the DJ booth with me and just tell me Van Halen stories for hours. It was wild. And he would draw all the time. It was a fascinating thing for me as a fan for life. It just was a great moment in time. And it just, in a way, it's so sad that at least if that moment would have happened with three, where you guys got to play at least two or three songs, that would have been something. Right. But one fucking note, Jesus Christ.
And yeah, he's I still am forever grateful to him. For having me along with his adventure, and he's still a hero of mine. And really, I learned so much from him. We really had a blast on the Eat 'Em and Smile Day. So
yeah, that's, and I like that you're the reason why the Spanish versions of those songs exist in that album, because you read somewhere that Spanish music or Spanish people were buying a lot of records. You're like, hey, let's record this album in Spanish.
Yeah, it's rudimentary conversational Spanish, and I don't speak any. So he showed me phonetically what to sing. We went into a studio, and Missing Persons were there during the day or during the evening. I'm not sure who's where. And so I sing at Del Bozio's microphone, and it had her lipstick and makeup and perfume all over it. So I got to smell Del Bozio. So it was a good thing.
Pretty wild. Let me ask you this. Oh, here we get. Oh, there it is. There it is.
All right, God, you got it together, bro.
That's so funny. Why is it not? Yeah. Didn't it say? Didn't the album title say it in Spanish?
That's what it says.
Yes, Sonrisa. And then I remember a shy boy was Timido, hasta luego, and Vuelto Loco, El Calor, going crazy from the heat. So I remember some of those.
That's really well. Yankee Rose apparently translates to the same as Yankee Rose. That's what I see there.
Some things did translate. Plus, I had to make the lyrics a little less lewd, if you will, because some of the Spanish-speaking countries like Mexico, they're Catholics, and they don't go for any lewd or rude language. So a couple things were cleaned up a little bit.
All right, before we go any further, you know these guys. We love these guys. It is Yo Kratom, YoKratom.com. We've been fans forever. They've been sponsors forever. They sponsor Skankfest. They've been sponsoring the SDR show for a long time. And the coolest thing about them, you know it, you get to buy a kilo of Kratom for just $60. $60 kilos of Kratom all day. Not only that, high-quality curated Kratom, their own strains, amazing customer service, and you won't find better prices anywhere. Just go to YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo and the official sponsor of the SDR show. Let me ask you this. We could go talk about every one of your bands for hours because there's so much rock and roll history here. But between, like, you think about Talas and David Lee Roth and Mr. Big and Winery Dog, blah, 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 Sons of Apollo, do you have a moment that sticks in your head as, like, your favorite rock and roll moment? And what band was that with?
Well, Mr. Big was on The Tonight Show, and I would always call my mom and say, "Hey, Mom, Mr. Big, we got a hit record. Oh, that's nice. Our record went platinum. Oh, that's good. Hey, we got number one MTV video. Yeah, that's nice." I say, "Mom, we're going to be on Tonight Show." "What? You're going to be on Tonight Show?" That was her metric for what success actually was. So it meant a lot to my mom. So we
Who
go
was
out
the host
there.
At the time? Who was the host?
Actually, Johnny still had it, but Jay was the host.
Oh, okay.
Johnny hadn't quite left yet. So Jay was the guest host that night, and he had us on. And to our surprise, they came in the green room and said, "Hey, Jay wants you guys on the couch. Who's going to sit in chair number one?" And so I was doing a lot of the talking for the band. I look at those guys, they look at me, and they pointed at me. Okay, here we go. So I actually sat in chair number one on the Tonight Show.
Wow, that's a great fucking memory. And also, last year was the 30th anniversary of Lean Into It, which
yeah.
I know you're not as involved. You're not involved. Like the label does those kind of things. But what I thought was cool was some of the bonus tracks were like missing the guitar line or missing the bass, so that a fan could play along. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. We had a great response to it. And that record was a life changer. To Be With You was a life changer. We get on an airplane and the flight attendant, "You guys in a band?" I go, yeah. "What band?" "Mr. Big." "I don't know." "I'm the one." "Oh my God." And then next thing you know, they're moving us to first class, giving them free drinks. The pilot's coming out and shaking our hand. And it was amazing. We're so grateful for what a run that was.
And I don't think people ever realized like the joke about being huge in Japan is a you know, a punchline, but no, Mr. Big was at one point the biggest selling artist, I think, in Japan, like as bigger than the Beatles. Like, you guys were ridiculously famous in Japan.
Well, we did well, but the Japan thing sometimes overshadows. At one point in Italy, there were four Mr. Big copy bands. And in South America, we played on the beach at Santos Beach outside of Sao Paulo, Brazil. 100,000 people on the beach.
Jesus.
It was insane. There were so many people that the police gave up and left.
Wow!
On stage with 100,000 people, and it was time to shut the concert down. We're ending, and I saw off in the distance, they called the military in. The army showed up.
Oh my God!
To get people off the beach. So it was we were very lucky to have such great international success, not only in Japan, always near and dear to our hearts, but everywhere. Indonesia, unbelievable. We a couple times we got, you know, situation at the airport where the fans were overwhelming and we got hurt and chased down.
Wow.
It was a crazy experience, but man, what a run. I wish that on all my musician friends. Have a hit single someday, bro. It's amazing.
Sadly, the drummer Pat passed away a few years ago, right? And now, but I've read somewhere that there is talks about potentially doing some shows next year. Is that rumors or is there more to it than just rumors?
We're talking about it. We got to find we had a Matt Starr fill in for Pat. He's a wonderful drummer, a dear friend. He's got a good voice, but what we need, Pat's range was really high. And we had a built in that Paul, myself, and Pat would be singing a three part and Eric would be on top of us. Mm-hmm. So we kind of need that. So we're looking for somebody with a higher voice and talking to a couple of people. So, but we would love to do it. Because at first, right away after we lost Pat, you know, we were deflated. We didn't really want to do anything. But a lot of wonderful fans have been very encouraging to us. They want to hear some more, and so we'd love to go out and play. So next year, a very good possibility of that.
Yeah, I got to see you guys at M3 with Pat. And I don't know how many years ago that was at this point, but that was a great to see that happen. It was really cool.
Oh yeah, what a riot.
Yeah, that was a great one. Now, so now it's funny because the album, the Talus record, is called 1985. And it's because all these songs were written, most of them, 99% of them, were written in 1985. This is the album that was supposed to come out in 1985. It's also kind of funny because the that Kate Bush song that had a huge comeback this year was also released in 1985. So it's a good year to be calling things 1985. So yep. Maybe it's synonymous or it's a sign. So all these songs were written, or have you actually, other than the one song, I think it was Black and Blue is the only new song, but was all these, are they written as is, or did you actually tweak them more, or what?
Good question. We had two choices. Shall we modernize them and make them slick and bring them up to date and fix the lyrics up and or get in the time machine and play it exactly the way we did. So we decided for the time machine, and we got in there and we went, Mark Miller, the drummer, a spectacular drummer. We went to his house in Rochester that he built from the ground up, from the dirt up. He's a brilliant craftsman and an architect now. And on the drum kit that he built, and we just did it just the way we used to do it. And we've been playing a couple of live shows just to kind of get up to speed. So everything felt real and righteous, and we had it together, and our memories were intact. And we did it the way we did it in 85. Got into the DeLorean time machine, and there we were.
Had some of those songs been played live already and just didn't make it to a record? That's where they were at?
Yeah, that was mostly our set. All those songs were on our set generally. Not all of them, but most of them were. So it was second nature for us to play them. So a lot of times a band will before they get signed to a record deal, will spend years playing these songs, and that first record is amazing. Then they've got 5 months to do another record as opposed to years. And so these songs have been played live for a long time, so we kind of had it built into our DNA, and it worked out very well. So we're pleased with the way they came out.
They always say you have a lifetime to write your first record and 6 months to write your second. I'm sorry, Don. What was your question, Don?
No, I was going to say, because Billy's so well known for playing the bass with his finger. It's not a pick guy, but you did play with a pick, at least partially, back in the Talis days.
Yeah, when we would do... the My Generation medley. I would use a pick for that part, and then I would throw it into the crowd for my dramatic moment, and that was
all right. Because I had a fan. I had a fan when we were doing that metal show. After you did our show, Billy caught me at a comedy show I was doing, and he had a pick from back in the Talis days, and it says Talis, the logo, and on the back it says Bill Sheehan.
Yep. Before I became Billy Sheehan.
Yeah, you were still Bill back there.
That was my shtick for a while, Don. When I was interviewing people on my old radio show, I would call them by the way no one would ever call them. Like, I called them Robert Halford, because no one says that, just to kind of confuse people, Steve Tyler, nobody liked it. He didn't like it, or Davey Coverdale, no one says it. I don't know why. And no one ever says William Sheehan. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, my mom called me that, so that's okay. She called me "Hey You" often. That was generally
the singer Phil, who passed away, was also in Coney Hatch, which is another band that had some heat on it back in the day. He passed away, but you did get to record this. You recorded it before he was sick, or was he already sick when you were recording?
Well, we were. I was here in my home in Nashville with Zoom or FaceTime as our talkback, which we talk back to the artists when they're at the mic. And I was producing the vocals with Phil. And then on my music computer, we had the output of the recording console so I could hear the track in real time, some amazing technology. So as I was working with him, I noticed that he would get a little bit scatterbrained once in a while, like sing a wrong word. And I'd point out, no, that it's a wrong word. And then he'd sing wrong again. Then Phil write it down. He'd sing it wrong again. I said, no. And finally, you get a lot on your mind when you're singing a track. Sometimes you don't always, that's a standing operating procedure. But I did notice that he had his attention on many things, but he got up to the mic every session and just killed. It was great. It was just, his voice was right on, and just incredible performance all the way through. Now that I know that he was shouldering the burden of knowing that he was in trouble again, because everything had gone into remission, but now it come back. And as any of us know, sadly, in the situations like that with cancer, remission is a good thing, but it doesn't mean you're completely out of the woods.
Right. And they say when it comes back a second time, you rarely survive it. That's over to my father. When it comes back, probably very, very, very low survival rate on that second round.
Exactly right. And so sadly, so he was shouldering that burden and still getting up to the mic and kicking ass every day. So I love Phil, and I was always impressed with him. And he's one of the sweetest guys I've ever known, and a great performer, and just the whole list of everything is stellar. But knowing that he knew that and still got up there to that mic and delivered was mind-blowing.
How does his son sound? His son's on a couple of tracks too, right?
Yeah, his son sounds very much like him. Looks like him and sounds like him.
So if you wanted to do a tour or do some dates, would you bring the son out as the singer?
That would be up to the son. I don't know. But he did sing on Black and Blue, and he sang Harmony on Crystal Clear and a few other songs. Did a great job. He's a wonderful kid. He has two sons that are both wonderful boys. And Phil was so proud to have his son on the record with him, too. And as I said, Phil was just a delightful human being, and not one trace of lead singer's disease in Phil. He's the sweetest guy, and we were devastated, of course. So we don't know if we can play at any point.
Right.
We've talked to a couple singers here and there about it. So hopefully we can at least go out and do a couple shows in his honor.
Would you say that Eric has a little bit of LSD, lead singer disease, or not really?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'll stumble through that one. No, Eric is good. Eric is a good guy. He's a good guy.
Yeah, Eric did the show not that long ago and sang to be with you, which normally he hates to do that, but he did do a couple of lines from to be with you on the show, which was kind of cool that he would do that.
Yeah, he's so great.
And he also, by the way, looks the same as the first time I met him 15 years ago. He hasn't fucking.
I don't know what's going on there. Some voodoo magic is happening.
It is fucking weird. It is weird. Let me ask you about this. During the height of the pandemic, someone told me you did some sort of all-star performance in Brentwood, Tennessee with Billy from Korn, the bass player from Bon Jovi. Like, how did that come about? What was that?
Phil X was living here for a while. Sadly, he moved back to California. I loved having him here. He's a dear friend and just what a supreme talent, man. He sings and plays so great. And what a great guy too. So his wife was doing things for the fire department of police where she would cook a huge giant meal, like a professional caterer, and take, as you called it, a hero drop. She'd drop off the food at the fire department or the police station and take care of them. So we did a little outdoor thing. No monitors. PA was this Bose thing that was behind us. No mics on the drums, no mics on the amps. Me, Phil, and Ray Lugier from Korn. Ray's another dear friend of mine. Lives here in Nashville. Incredible player.
And you just released a song with him, with that guy, what's his name? Anthony Goldman.
Video just came out. So we got up there and just played. And Bon Jovi bass player was there too. So I gave him my bass. He got up and played with Phil a couple songs too. But as the sun was going down, we realized there's no lights. So it's getting darker and darker and darker. And we're in the dark playing. There was a couple hundred people there. So everybody got their iPhones and turned the light on and shined.
That's hilarious. That's so cool.
It was hilarious, but it was great. And what a joy to play with Phil and Ray. Ray is just mind-blowing. And so it was interesting. That was the only gig I've done for quite a while. Other than last night, I got up with Richie Kotzen. He played here at Nashville.
Oh, wow. See, this is why people love Billy so much. But he had the same amount of joy telling that story where he played in front of 200 people in a parking lot as he did when he played in front of 100,000 people on the beach in South America. Yeah. Still get that same joy, huh, Bill?
I do. I started playing in tiny clubs, and I often talk about the relationship with the audience because there was no dressing room. So the stage is this high. We'd get done with a set. We'd step off the stage and sit down with the people in the audience, hang out, tell stories, whatever, look up at the clock, what time for set number two, we get up and play. So we're never that separation between the band and the audience. And I've always hung on to that. You know,
that's where you and I differ. I prefer to be above everyone. I feel very elitist. I like it better.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
By the way, Billy, I find this hard to believe, and maybe it's not true, because, you know, I try and do my research.
Okay.
Is this true that, I mean, you are heralded as I said, five-time best rock bass player. Do you really still practice every fucking day?
Right in this room for hours every day. I get up.
That's crazy.
Feed the cat, feed the birds so the cat has something to look at. And sit down and go. And I'm still learning, man. There's always more. It never ends. It's pretty cool. I had a kid write to me years ago via email. I've been playing bass for 6 months and I'm bored. What should I do? And I just wrote, quit, bro. You know, this is not for you. It's something else. Because I'm in my car and like hurry to get home because I got an idea. Oh, what if I, you know, and grab my bass and try the new thing. So I'm so thankful that I still have that enthusiasm and true desire to learn more and do more. Doesn't mean play faster or play more. It just means to learn more. And I don't know what it is about me that has that built in, but that's the thing. One of the things I'm so thankful for, that I still love to learn and figure things out. And
do you remember the last time you heard a song somewhere and you heard a bass line? You're like, well, that's different. How did that guy, like, how did that happen? Like, did that happen to you?
Yeah, well, in the days of Instagram and Facebook, you got a lot of musicians posting things, and there's all these young guys playing these wild-ass crazy things. And I stole so much from the bass players that came before me, and I know there are some bass players that claim that they took some things from me. So I figure, well, it's fair enough that I take some of those things back again. And, and so I always learn from everyone, not just bass either. Drummers, I'm a big drum fan, and drumming, and I've been lucky to play with some great drummers, and bass and drums are that things that holds the band together. So that's important. So
I would feel that, I mean, maybe I'm wrong because I don't know bass that well, but to be with you's bass line is very McCartney-esque. Is that a fair assumption?
It's very fair, and there's actually a part in there that's directly from when it goes. That's right from Sergeant Pepper's.
Oh, okay. Look at me knowing music. How cool is that?
You hit the nail on the head. That's pretty good.
God damn it. All right, so now I have a couple other questions for you. Then we're going to do the first, which I didn't get to tell you about at the beginning of the show, but we'll explain that in a minute. But this one is cool. It's totally unrelated to your music career, but it's related to you. I read somewhere that on your birthday a few years ago, which is crazy if this is true, you were given Motown Masters of like the Jackson 5 and Rick James. And you have these like things where you can hear them separated out. And that someone just gave that to you?
Well, there was a friend of mine in Pittsburgh, and he had a club. And he had a karaoke night. And he says to me, you know, I've got all these Motown songs that are designed for karaoke. It's got the band on the left channel and the lead vocal on the right. And his name is Randy. I said, Randy, it couldn't be the actual song. I mean, how would they even do that? Right. And so my birthday comes along and he sends me 18 CDs of Motown karaoke. And it's Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, The Temptations, all these, Stevie Wonder, their lead vocal isolated on one side. Spooky, amazingly incredible recording, and the band on the other side. So for karaoke players, they could just mute out the voice and you can sing along with the real track. And I couldn't believe it. So I actually tried to get in touch with Motown and said, you guys got, this is golden. We should just release this as a box set of just all these vocals. And I posted Michael Jackson the other day and The Temptations, I'll Be There. And you can hear their feet shuffling on the floor and hear them breathing.
Wow.
Oh, God, it's unbelievable. So I've had that around. I'll post some more stuff of it at some point or another. But pretty amazing to hear. And I remember right when Michael Jackson died, my wife and a lot of her friends were big fans. So I played, you know, I'll Be There and some of the songs. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And this kid just nailed it. It was before he could do pitch correction or.
Right. It's always, I always say how amazing that is when you hear these old songs. Like, no, auto-tune didn't exist then. That's fucking crazy, is that? It's wild.
Mind-blowing.
Yeah. So now, John. What did you say, John?
I call him Mike Jackson, by the way.
That's us.
Because nobody else does.
Yeah, that's us. Or Mikey Jackson.
Good callback.
So one of your other bands, because it is wild to see how many different projects you're in. You know, is Sons of Apollo was one of your newest bands. They're going out and you were not going to go with them than you were. What actually is going on with you and Sons of Apollo?
Oh, nothing between me and the band. Brazil's got some restrictive policies about who gets in the country, and I didn't qualify. So
it because of your police ridden past?
Yeah, I was arrested for three felony counts in 1971. Which is actually true, by the way.
Is that really true?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. But that's not.
I have an even more important question. So I follow Billy on Instagram, mm-hmm. and I saw that he posted that he created a drink. It's a mixture with vodka and A1 steak sauce.
Woo-hoo!
And so now I know Billy and I have shared a few glasses of wine before, and I know he knows his reds, but I followed his post and I tried it myself and it went terribly wrong. What did I do wrong?
I know what you did wrong. You listen to Billy Sheehan when it comes to making a drink. That sounds horrible.
Actually, oddly enough, we did it about 50-50 or 40-60 vodka being at the 40. I thought it was delicious because if you don't like A1, and my wife's from Italy and her Italian friends think A1 is just an abomination unto the Lord. The steak is just, you know, steak. But I do like an A1, not on a great steak, but on a good steak or whatever. But it actually was pretty good. We tried, and then I posted, we need a name for this drink. And I think the winner eventually was steak and taters because of the vodka. So next time I see you, Don, I'll try to do it properly and mix it.
I have a good title for the drink. My title is Don't Drink This. How about that?
You could do that. Actually, it wasn't bad. The people we were with were split 50-50. Some liked it and some despised it. So
that's what, I went to cooking school and I ran a restaurant for a few years. And at the cooking school, the chef teacher said there's certain things that you don't need to bother making because people are always going to prefer the original. And he used A1 steak sauce as one of them, that people are just going to ask for A1, so don't make your own steak sauce.
Exactly.
So now, let me ask you this. This is an interesting topic, and learning about you, did not know how much of a, I think your whole life, or at least 20, 30 years, you're very open about being a Scientologist, right? My question would be, what is the biggest misconception of Scientology?
Oh, so it's a lot of them.
I'm not a religious person at all of any kind. So I just find it fascinating because it is, I would say, one of the newer religions. Is that a fair way to look at it? Right.
Absolutely.
Compared to the others. But like, if you say this is the one thing or one of the things that I think about how people get this wrong all the time about Scientology.
Well, we go to doctors when, we believe in science and believe in education. Education is a big thing. I'm a language buff and a word definition buff. And that's a foundation to understanding everything, is understanding the language and definition of words. Science, I've been a science buff my whole life. I was a little junior paleontologist, astronomer, biologist. I had my microscope lab when I was a little kid. So I'm grounded in science. My mother worked for Roswell Park Institute, a famous cancer institute in Buffalo, New York. Mm-hmm. We had a medical scientific background in our house and family. So truth and fact and 2 + 2 = 4 is a very important thing to me. And that's what I believe it's all about. I don't talk much about this subject only because I know there's a lot of detractors that get upset when anybody speaks about it. I understand that. But I do stick to my guns. And I know it's a good thing with good people. There's some amazing rumors floating around and a lot of bad stories. I would never be involved in something that was not on the up and up. And I've been there for over 50 years. And
wow.
It's been an incredible adventure, been incredibly helpful to me and my life. I did a little bit of drugs in high school. They had a wonderful program to clean the drugs out of your body and start over again. And it was a wonderful thing for me. You do an IQ test before and after, and it's amazing how many points you'll gain.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. That's
pretty
cool.
Interesting. So, but I respect all religions, and I respect people that disagree too.
What I liked is I saw you say that you would go to these like rallies in an anonymous mask or something and ask people to just kind of have a discussion about it, which I think is cool.
There was one incident where Anonymous had a big protest, and I didn't tell anybody at Scientology because they would have said, don't do that, because they had already done some death threats and some destruction and stuff like that. I said, you know what? Put your money where your mouth is. So I walked down with a sign and said, hey, I'm here. You want to talk to me? And a couple of people screamed at me and yelled at me, and it was an amazing experience. But I did speak with a lot of people in an intelligent manner and discuss things fairly. And many of the anonymous people came up to me afterwards, shook my hand, and thanked me for being there. And it was an interesting play. I could not understand what it's like to be in a situation where you had a lot of people against you and you were all alone. And I would never compare my experience to people that have done that, but it was a little taste of what that would be like. And it was interesting to stand up for something you believe in. It was quite a day for me.
I give you credit. It's pretty cool. It takes a lot of balls to do that. It's pretty impressive.
I didn't tell anybody. One time, my wife got mad at me, and everybody got pissed at me. But I said, you know, stand for something or you'll fall for anything.
And also you said, which I don't know why you picked this song. If you could write, if you wish you wrote one song that you didn't write, you said, If I Fell by the Beatles. Why?
Because I think it's one of the greatest songs I've ever written. It's just the chord changes are so, they're complex, but they don't sound complex. And the message is just so, so touching and so beautiful. If I Fell, just
Did you ever meet Paul McCartney?
I have not. Well, Greg Bissonette plays with Ringo now. So at one point he played in L.A. and we're texting back and forth, and I was going to go back, and I thought, you know, he's probably in hell because all his friends want to go backstage and everything. Right. So my wife and I, we started walking to the car, got halfway there, and texted, Billy, where are you? And I go, sorry, Greg, I thought you were in hell. So and maybe I could have gotten in and meeting a Beatle.
I did this with Ringo Starr. We were passing each other in a hallway, and I went like this, and he gave it to me back. So that's, I sort of met him, I guess.
Did you call him Richard?
All right, so now we got to do the first. Before we wrap up with the first, Don, you have any other last questions before I do it?
No, let's get to the meat.
All right.
The first time ever I saw concert Detroit had sex.
The name of the show, William, is the SDR show. We ask everybody this question since the dawn of time. The Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show, your first experience with all three. We start with rock and roll, and we ask you the first concert you ever went to. Doesn't have to be a rock show, just the first concert that you went to on your own volition.
Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, my God. That's a good one.
Buffalo Auditorium. On the original experience, 1968, Soft Machine opening up, and my life was changed.
Wow, that's really cool. What year was that?
1968.
Wow. By the way, I know you grew up in Buffalo. Do you have a buffalo wing recipe that is your favorite?
No, but I often get the Anchor Bar sauce and just put it on a regular chicken, too, like a chicken breast or a little whatever. That's quite good.
Or mix with vodka.
There you go. That could be the next one.
I had that once.
Wing sauce and maybe vodka and blue cheese would be next. I don't know.
Yeah, why not? That's right. You know,
you said celery.
When you were a kid, you dabbled in drugs a little bit when you were a kid. What was the first drug you ever did after weed, unless weed wasn't your first?
No, weed was my first. And I remember back in the day, because marijuana was nowhere near it, the way it is now as far as how powerful it is. And we'd sit around and we'd smoke a joint or make some kind of a little pipe thing like that. And we'd look at each other. Did anything happen yet? Feel anything yet? No. Well, now, half a toke and the emergency medical technicians are showing up. So it was a different way of experiencing. But I remember the first time realizing that we were actually high was quite an amazing thing. And I enjoyed smoking marijuana. I enjoyed the sensation. But I heard a tape of our show after we had gotten stoned, thinking it was one of the greatest performances that mankind has ever seen, and realized it was far from that. So that was a very contributing factor in me to saying, you know, maybe I should just lay off. And so since 1971, I haven't even had an aspirin. So
wow. But you do drink a little bit here and there. You do dabble in the alcohol.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do enjoy that.
Especially if it's mixed with A1 sauce. Okay. And what about the first time Billy had sex? How old were you?
Oh, man, I was a late starter in that I was a little bit shy, hence the song, Shy Boy. We were at a club, and there was a woman I had seen at another club, and she was this tall, statuesque, beautiful blonde girl, very well endowed, and I remember her walking through the crowd and hands you know, of guys coming up to just to touch her. And she kept walking without even blinking and just walked through the crowd. It was like a mystical, weird experience. So we're playing a show down the street from that bar, and there she is. I couldn't believe it. And so I got off stage, and I'm standing there by the bar, and there's a tap on my shoulder. I turn around, and that's her. And so she started talking to me, and we ended up going somewhere. And she was quite an experienced woman of the world, and I was a newbie. And she had mercy on me, and got me through the procedure unharmed. And it was an amazing. She dropped me off near my house, and I never saw her again.
Wow, the world needs more women like that, Billy. That's all I'll say.
Thank you.
All right, so now the album 1985 is coming out like any day now. I think it's coming out on this month, right? The full album?
23rd. Yeah, the 23rd.
Right, and obviously there's 8,000 bands that you're in. We could promote them all from Talas to Sons of Apollo to Winery Dogs, I think still exists, right? There's rumors that a new record's going to come out with Winery Dogs too?
New Winery Dogs is finished, mixed and mastered. I've even seen the cover art, so it's going to be out soon. They're booking shows for next year now, and we're very excited about that. And it's actually not that many bands. I mean, I play in mostly Winery Dogs, Sons of Apollo. Mr. Big is kind of on hold. Talas is a thing from long ago, and that's pretty much it. Maybe Niacin, another.
Niacin's another one, but that's not really rock. That's like jazzy kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, it's a little more fusion, proggy. Dennis Chambers on drums. He's a grandmaster. And so there's not all that many. And the timing of everything is such that one tour is done, and I can sit around on my ass for a whole year or play shows with another band, you know? Yeah. So
unless, of course, David calls and the classic lineup gets together for one more show, sans a fire marshal.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have it in a bigger place with all the accommodations correctly. Yeah, well, we'd love to do that. I mean, myself, Steve, and Greg, you know, we all still hold Dave in high regard. And if it ever come, I don't think it's gonna. But if it ever would come, I'm sure all of us would love to do it.
And it's at Billy Sheehan on bass on Instagram. Now, do we have anything else we want to plug before we go around and do our plugs?
No, that should do it. New Winery Dogs coming. New Talas is about here. And
you want to leak the name of the new Winery Dogs album right now?
No, they get mad at me.
It's worth a shot. It's worth a shot.
I keep my secrets.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I asked the wrong person. Don, your plug.
At Don Jameson Official on Instagram and Facebook, and Real Don Jameson on Twitter. That's it.
Okay. Shannon, your plugs?
You can follow me on Instagram at ShannonLee6982 and listen to my podcast, The Thing Is Ding. We talk about bad dates, fighting, and ghosts. We have all sorts of interesting guests come on, comedians, musicians, reality TV stars, and porn stars, and they tell their own personal stories about their worst date experience, a time they got into a street fight, and an experience with the paranormal.
Okay, now, Billy, don't give any indication, Billy. This is going to be an interesting one. We always ask the guests at the end of the show if they believe in ghosts. And do not respond to all three of us lock in, please. It's a hard one for me. I feel like it's yes. Don?
I'm going yes.
Shannon?
So I'm trying to tap into all the bits and pieces of stuff that I have heard about Scientology. And I believe that there is an element of like reincarnation in there, but I don't know if the spirits are ever disembodied and just roaming the earth. I'm really having a hard time. Wait, don't answer yet. But I am dying to know the answer to this. I am going to say.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm going to say no.
Okay. Well,
you get points for showing your work.
I've seen some incredible evidence of what you're talking about. And I had a drop cam, a Nest cam in my garage in my condo in L.A. And you get alerts when something moves, and I'd get an alert and I'd look at on my phone, and there it was, a ball of light floating around in my garage. And I thought, it's got to be a dust particle or something. I'm a scientific type person. So I remember the next time it went off, I kind of ran down, quick open the door, nothing. Next time it went on, I walked down slowly and quietly opened the door, nothing. But I had about 10 videos of these. And if it was a wind blowing and our garage was sealed, so nothing, but they would just float around randomly in the room. I showed many of my friends, blew their mind. plain as day, floating around in the garage in my Sherman Oaks condo. So I don't know what they were. I don't know whether they were disembodied spirits or what a disembodied spirit might look like. But I do believe that we've lived before. I believe we will live again. And that's I respect those who do not believe that. But I think that we have occasional disembodied person around. I think way more people mistake something for that, and it is not that. And we do. Everybody's got a cell phone camera within arm's reach, so proof still hasn't come through as strong as I wish it would. Same with flying saucers. Everybody's got a 35 millimeter camera in their iPhone. We should have a couple of good pictures by now. Yeah. You think? But nevertheless, I do believe that is the case.
So it's a long story short, the answer is yes, you do believe.
Sir.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other podcast on health and wellness is called The Good Sugar Podcast. And our first store is going to be opening up in October on the corner of 3rd Avenue and 69th Street. So come down and get some vegan food and some healthy stuff there as well. We're going to add a song to the playlist, the sdrshow.com/playlist. The newest, and I put newest in quotes, single from Talas is Don't Try to Stop Me from 1985. I believe that just came out a couple days ago. So we'll add that to the playlist.
Great.
Billy, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was an honor to have you, buddy.
My pleasure, Ralph. Don, great to see you. Shannon, nice to meet you. And I hope I see you all around very soon. Thanks
for having me. If I ever see you in person, though, I will not accept a drink of vodka and barbecue sauce.
Okay, I promise.
That's more for me and Billy.
Fantastic.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks very much, all of you. Thank you.